"Why, doctor," she said simply, "I'm a Christian. I wouldn't do that." Now, you see, for her personally, and I'm sure for legions of others like her, all the theorizing and all the discussion on the subject and all of the legal paraphernalia that goes with it, and the attempts and initiatives to establish a legal right to suicide or assistance to suicide, are irrelevant. "I'm a Christian. I wouldn't do that," she said. And I asked her if I could use that quote from her, and she readily agreed to allow me to do so. And what a contrast that is with the philosophy, for instance, of the Hemlock Society. The avoidance of suffering, of course, has been cited as the primary purpose, no doubt, of given by advocates of suicide or legalization of assistance for suicide. I certainly don't propose to give any final answer to the myriad of questions that arise, sometimes as big as a house, concerning human suffering. But not all suffering is detrimental, and in fact, for the Christian, ultimately, none of it is, even when we don't understand its purpose. Now, I know that that's a strong statement, and yet I believe that to be true. Ultimately, none of it is. There is massive anecdotal evidence of the possibility of a full and rewarding life in spite of extensive suffering and extreme limitations due to illness or injury. Now, here's one example. Ken McGarity was a helicopter pilot during the Vietnam conflict. His craft was hit by a rocket. He was massively wounded, brought to the hospital, one leg hanging by a thread, the other is very badly injured, one eye gone, the other also badly injured. And during 9 hours of surgery, Dr. Kenneth Swan wondered whether he was doing the right thing in saving McGarity's life. Is it right to help someone to live on in a life that obviously would be lived in misery? Well, he was reassured by the conviction that his patient would soon die. But, of course, he didn't die. Though blind, legless, suffering from other wounds, he survived to undergo additional bouts of surgery. And as he was recovering from these, almost miraculously, or perhaps miraculously, one day a friend encouraged him to go to the PX for snacks, and he bumped along against the walls and so on, but he finally made it. And then he knew he was going to be all right. And today he retains a great interest in life. He's married, he has 2 children, and he includes scuba diving among his many activities. And meanwhile, for years, Dr. Swan was haunted by the memory of that pitiful wreck of humanity, and he often asked himself the same question that had plagued him as he performed that initial life-saving surgery. 23 years after their first meeting, McGarity, who cherished life, and Swan, the troubled physician, were reunited. And the former helicopter pilot who had was given an opportunity to meet and to thank the former field hospital doctor who had given him another chance at life. And then Dr. Swan knew the answer to his question. It certainly was fortunate that McGarity's encounter with the medical profession was with Dr. Swan rather than with Dr. Kevorkian. One more example, if you will. A very close friend of mine has been afflicted with multiple sclerosis for 45 years. He's much more disabled than any of the individuals who have been prematurely hurled into eternity by Dr. Death's handy-dandy death machine. He's wheelchair-bound. His speech and coordination are greatly affected. He suffers from other limitations, and nevertheless, he continues to work every day. He travels with assistance, continues to make a contribution to society, and gives thanks to God every day for his life. Now, it's granted, of course, that these examples are anecdotal. They make no pretense of scientific conclusion, but I believe they demonstrate the vast importance of attitude, which is such a life and death difference in so many situations. And it's also true that not every sufferer has these options open to him that my friend has, as limited as they might be. There are those who have been poignantly described by John Milton in his statement from his classic sonnet, "They also serve who only sit and wait." But I believe that Milton's deep perception is far more on target with the divine scheme of things than that of those who urge that life be ended when it is no longer perceived to be useful or rewarding. But in concert with the third article of the Christian Creed, the believer's perspective is given astonishing resilience by a dependence upon the promise that the Lord will not permit his people to suffer beyond their capacity, and that he will call us to himself when he determines that the time is right. Now, of course, this paper does not propose to deal with these attempts at extending life for a few days or weeks or hours, as the case may be. I think that's been very adequately covered before. But I want to talk about avoidance of suffering particularly. And another reason given is that loss of dignity. You know, you have that initiative that was labeled death with dignity. That's often the lack of dignity is often perceived to accompany terminal illness. But what is true dignity? The manner of the death of our Lord was most ignominious, and yet he died with great dignity. Now, of course, one needs to be very cautious in comparisons with our Lord, because we are not God as he is. But there are many things from his life that are exemplary for those who desire to live in a godly manner or to die in a godly manner. True dignity is something that can be conferred upon an individual ultimately only by God. But nothing can destroy the dignity that he gives. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about a little excursus, as your quasi-outline talks about, regarding the matter of manic depression. However, I'm going to skip that for a moment in case I run out of time and my monitor here tells me it's all over. But one of the descriptions of this seminar promises a Christian perspective of bioethics from before the cradle to beyond the grave. Now, that part before the cradle is not in the purview of this paper, but within its range is the factor that the Christian perspective is always beyond the grave. It's not necessary to justify that part of the description by a discussion of organ transplants or other post-death questions, as useful as that might be, because the Christian perspective is always eschatological. Now, how does suicide affect the life beyond? Well, the biblical teaching is that what destroys a relationship with God is unbelief. Unbelief rejects divine forgiveness, without which there is no entry into the life beyond the grave. And if you accept the position that suicide by a rational individual ordinarily is a violation of the law of God, then the obvious problem which presents itself is that the final act of such a person is an act of unbelief. And even a slow death offers little hope of the kind of change of heart with which Christian faith implies. And of course, it's not something we can bring about either, but is by the Holy Spirit. Self-deliverance is a phrase which is becoming popular among those who advocate suicide as an alternative to terminal illness. Eschatology asks the question, deliverance to what? And the answer to that question is not comforting. Just as self-righteousness is a most persistent idolatry, so also is self-deliverance. The emphasis in both is on the self without reference to God. The ancient liturgy quotes the psalm which implores, "Make haste, O God, to deliver me." It's from Psalm 70, verse 1, the King James. Yet even while requesting speed on the part of God, the psalmist recognizes that deliverance will come from God, not from himself. And even beyond God's claim upon the individual is that responsibility for the impact of his action upon others. And that has been dealt with also by the previous speakers. And you know that it's one thing to say, well, I can do what I want with my life, and what I do is nobody else's business. It's quite another thing to keep what I do with my life from affecting others, often many others, and particularly so if you're in any position as a role model. If no man is an island, as John Donne, the English divine, rightly declares, then there is necessarily a societal impact which is unavoidable. And that, too, is a frequently expressed biblical concept. One societal impact of self-deliverance is the suffering, sometimes intense, which is inflicted upon the family and friends by the act of suicide. And I won't go into that in great detail. And I think about a number of cases in my own experience where that has just been an agonizing question for those survivors. Another very troubling aspect of this approach to avoid suffering is its effect upon youth. Suffering. It's for the avoidance of suffering. Who suffers more than youth? Now, if your teen years were tranquil and halcyon years, you were not only fortunate, but exceptional. And you have certainly witnessed, at least in others, the tortured self-doubt and the mental anguish that so often exists in the minds of those who endure the turbulent years between 12 and 20. When the anguish of youth becomes so exaggerated, and when maturity of judgment is so lacking, and when a kind of solipsism disregards friends and family and God and everything else, more and more of the youth of our society are resorting to suicide. As you know, undoubtedly, these numbers have been and will continue to be multiplied by an increasing societal acceptance of self-termination as a rational antidote to suffering. And of course, that's not restricted to youth, but I remember with such anguished clarity an eighth grader in our school who was, I'm sure, led into this by the societal impact of this self-deliverance. I never want to go through that again. Another pertinent question is, what reason is there to suppose that once sanitized and legalized death centers are put into place, as is being advocated, access to them will be limited to those who are suffering physically? Now, I've asked hundreds of people in different times and circumstances which they think has the greater potential for producing the most extreme suffering, physical pain or mental anguish. And I have never had a response which says that physical suffering is greater or can be greater than mental anguish. Now, that doesn't mean I never will. It doesn't mean that the answer I invariably receive is correct. But let's extend this survey and go interactive for a moment. How many of you feel that physical suffering has a greater potential for anguish than mental suffering? How many do? Well, I take that either to be acquiescence or a reticence to this kind of interaction. At any rate, there is a widespread belief that that is so. But then just think how cruel it may be considered in some future time to deny the supposed benefit of death centers to those who are suffering only mentally. The applicant may qualify for termination by simply demonstrating a certain angst level. Now, that may seem bizarre or far-fetched until you realize it's already happening. At least one of those terminated by Dr. Death, as far as I can determine, was not suffering physically at all, but was suffering only mental anguish occasioned by the prospect and not even the certainty, because if I understand it correctly, only post-mortem is going to determine the certainty of Alzheimer's. But what she feared and had a mental anguish over the prospect of Alzheimer's disease. But again, of course, from a Christian perspective, neither genre of suffering, physical or mental, justifies taking one's life. Now, I want to view one other troubling potential from a theological perspective. When a society wants to eliminate or to subjugate a certain segment of the population, one way to do it is to declare those who are in that segment to be non-persons. You see, you can make an end run around all these litigations and Supreme Court decisions and everything else. Therefore, as non-persons, they do not possess the rights of a person and the constitutional protection. In the history of our own society, we've seen a succession of subgroups who have been dealt with in this way. Indians at one time were not accorded constitutional rights because they were not considered persons. Black slaves were treated not as persons, but as property, also not accorded the right of persons. Now, fortunately, these anomalies have been corrected for these two groups, but not for the third group in our day, that is, the unborn, as you well know. And although our laws are somewhat ambivalent in this regard, much of the justification for the legal right to kill an unborn child at will derives from his or her lack of constitutional standing as a person. Roe v. Wade baldly declared that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, does not include the unborn. It's particularly ominous, therefore, that questions regarding the personhood of the terminally ill are becoming increasingly common. William Brennan of St. Louis University cites a report published in the New England Journal of Medicine in which a group of doctors and ethicists recommends inclusion in the ethics curriculum of medical schools the question, when does a dying person cease to be a person? I should have said that a little differently. I misquoted. When does a dying patient cease to be a person? He also notes that Roger Cranfield, a neurologist, envisions a time when those in persistent vegetative state will be equated with non-personhood. And as this thinking becomes more widespread, its potential for great evil becomes more and more obvious. From a theological perspective, however, we believe that every individual, sick or well, born or unborn, sleeping or waking, conscious or comatose, is known to his Creator as a person and is treasured in his sight. The inclusive language of Scripture in this regard belies any efforts to exclude certain individuals or groups of Homo sapiens as persons. In summary of all, it's my belief that it is an arrogant thing and an arrogation of rights, God's rights, to presume to make a determination of the time of death for self or for someone else. It calls to mind the words of the philosopher Montaigne, and will you add an E at the end of that name on your outline that kind of slipped off of there somehow? Montaigne said, man must surely be mad. He cannot make a worm, yet he creates gods by the score. And the apogee of such God creating is to create self as God. That's the ultimate effect, I believe, of the philosophy and practice of euthanasia. And just as it's idolatry for man to determine his own means of salvation, so it's idolatry for him to determine the means by which he enters eternity. It's a declaration that the means by which and the time in which God brings us to himself are rejected in favor of my own means, my own time. And I believe that it's vital and it is right. And it is a far grander thing to maintain a very high sense, not only of the value of human life, but of the sanctity of life. And I believe this is so because life is God-given, because life belongs to God, and because he has restored immortality for mankind. But I believe also that the best approach from a theological perspective is not with the major emphasis upon the first article of the creed, because that so easily leads to a law orientation and often stops there. But I suggest that great stress be placed upon the second article of redemption and upon the warm and sparkling truths of the third article, in which the splendid, restorative, dignity-conferring work of the Holy Spirit has center stage. And the value that God places upon life can be measured by no less than the giving of the life of his own Son so that we can have life, and the giving of his Spirit to bring this life to us. And we, his creation, have been given the capacity to reach toward the goal of measuring it in that exalted fashion. Thank you very much.
We're right on schedule. I certainly did not want to terminate that presentation, though we would have done it with great dignity. The floor is now open for questions and discussion, and all three of our panelists from this morning's papers will be pleased to receive them. Please, go ahead. I think that mic is on. Test it. Yes.
Yeah, it is. I want to bring up something that came up in our ethics committee at our hospital just last month, as a matter of fact. A physician who is the head physician for the prisoners that come into our hospital brought this particular scenario up. If a prisoner has refused food and has determined that he wants to commit suicide because of a cause, and all of a sudden, on a certain day when he becomes either comatose or hallucinating or whatever might happen, he arrives at our emergency door, and we have to make the decision or the choice of what do we do. When we're talking about self-determination and autonomy, do we let that prisoner die because of the cause for which he represents, and the cause would be lost if he did not die? That's interesting that a lawyer brought that point up. Anyway, I think or do we let that person die and with dignity for his cause, be it against food or whatever it is?
Well, I'm going to respond to that by asking Gil Myliner to respond to that. And my reason for it is that some 5 or 6 years ago, there were a series of essays and issues in Law and Medicine that dealt with hypothetical cases. And Gil drafted one of the best responses to that particular question, and on the basis of that, I'd ask him to answer.
What did I say? This is a little different kind of case, though, that you raised. Didn't you tell me at breakfast you're from Indianapolis?
Yeah.
Could be Mike Tyson.
It could be, but yeah, because he tried it, incidentally.
I'm just stalling for time. There might be, let me tell you my view, Gene will probably be sorry he deferred to me and want to correct it in a second. There might be circumstances in which I think it would be the morally appropriate thing to let such a person starve himself to death in the kind of circumstance you sketched out. This is a protest of some kind on behalf of some sort of cause, because there could be circumstances in which I wouldn't call that suicide. If you do, you may find yourself backed into a corner of having to call every martyr a suicide. There can be occasions on which one takes action that means that one, with almost certainty, foresees one's death resulting from it. That does not necessarily mean that you're aiming at your death. And it's not a suicidal action unless one aims at one's death. The martyr, in many circumstances, certainly foresees death, but the aim is loyalty to God, say, something like that. To the degree that you're sketching out a case that could be analogous to that, then I think, you know, there's an argument to be made. Now, cases differ, we'd have to talk about them, but it wouldn't be ruled out in my view. Now, Gene, you want to correct that?
No, I don't, but I'd like to add to it that the case that you raise, I think the first question I would ask is, does this man have an advance directive? Has he given some consideration to that? Further, I would also suggest that in many states there are now provisions in the statutes that people who engage in this kind of discussion are eligible also for counseling. And as a prison person involved in the welfare of his people in a prison, that might be something you should want to explore with that person. Further, I'd also remind you that given a set of unacceptable circumstances, the prison doctor may well have the authority to override the individual's request.
Okay. Thank you.
With a long line of speakers and perhaps more yet to come, I'd ask that you make your questions brief and succinct, and if you wish, address them to a specific member of the panel. Otherwise, they will respond as they see fit.
Thank you. My name is Jean Heisey. Yesterday, there are many expressions of gratitude to the professionals who attended this conference for the sacrifice they made. I'd like you to know that I'm here as a full-time volunteer. And I'd like to speak on behalf of the volunteers for Lutherans for Life who go to great lengths to educate themselves on the subject of euthanasia, that we may speak to our pastors in our area. Dr. Lindsay referred to his new friend, Abby, which is my aging golden retriever. She's 70 in human years, and her quality of life has become very irritating to me, and therefore she now has membership in 3 euthanasia societies. I break the code of ethics, and I read her private mail. And I also read their books. I must say that when we speak to groups of Lutheran pastors, particularly when we point out the origin of the living will and its purpose to grease the skids in euthanasia, we face tremendous criticism. We are told we are not bioethicists, we're not theologians, we are not professionals. Therefore, we do not have the right to deal with the subject of euthanasia, and that Lutherans for Life should get out of the subject. I've had a fist shaken in my face over that issue. Do we, as laypersons, have the right to address this issue to our clergy? Or is this subject reserved only for the professionals? And I thank you, Dr. Lindsay, if you would reply to that question.
Thank you very much, Jean, for raising that question. Let me give you the response from the perspective of a citizen. If there is a fundamental right in the United States Constitution, is the right to freedom of expression or the freedom of speech. And as such, every citizen has the responsibility, not just the privilege or the prerogative, but the responsibility of addressing issues that keep our society functioning in a fashion consistent with our fundamental principles.
I just mention one practical thing in regard to this also. The Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod, Lutherans for Life Executive Director, has helped prepare a Christian declaration on life that I'd like you to take a look at and see if you don't find that a very fine instrument for this very kind of thing that you speak of. And certainly we want to be delivered from the professionals and not have turned everything over to them. Life is too important for that.
I'm Terry Weber. I'm a nurse from St. Louis, and I want to respond, or actually make a comment, to Dr. Mylander. You said something that I thought is really important and that we need to emphasize. I had a friend who died from AIDS a few months ago, and he did not choose suicide as some that have this have chosen to do. But he also didn't want to be abandoned. And I think that was really important, that we don't abandon these people, that we continue to support them, not just people with AIDS, but women who are facing unwanted pregnancies, unwanted babies, and so on. What we were able to do with my friend, even though he never received a physical cure, he certainly enjoyed a spiritual healing. And I think that's important. Thank you.
Not really a question, but I do have something to say in response to it. And it's important to keep in mind, I've been reading the bioethics literature for 20 years now. When I started, at least that part of the literature that focused on questions about care for the dying was concerned chiefly with what you might call medical over-treatment and getting patients the right to participate in decisions about their care, to refuse treatment, and so forth. Over that 20-year period, the thing has swung in certain ways, so that often now it's, and the Wangley case that Jean Lindsay talked about is a perfect example of it, that it's sometimes medical caregivers who want to stop, and therefore kind of concerns have shifted, and you can sense that even in a group like this, the concern shifts toward insisting that care be given on certain occasions. But we oughtn't to let that, I'm making my way around to your comment, we oughtn't to let that lead us to forget that the received ethic, as I described it, though it prohibited killing, and therefore, you know, did say that care was to be given on a number of occasions, also acknowledged that allowing to die should take place, and that that was part of not abandoning someone, being present with them, but not striving endlessly to keep them alive. And I don't think that the true fact that the whole medical ethics discussion has shifted in certain respects that leads to new worries, should we should not let that cause us to forget the other side of it, which is that there are many occasions when we ought to acknowledge that death is coming, stop trying to ward it off, and simply try to company with that person in their dying.
Richard Thur, St. Genevieve, Missouri. I'm a pastor. Out west recently, one of the states or cities, some area, voted to not ration the medical procedures for some people. And I'd like the opinion of all three of the panel. Should the state have some laws concerning which procedures the state will pay for? Like heart transplants, would they pay for those for everybody? And I think they had a whole list of things that, you know what I'm talking about then. But the opinion of all three of the panelists on that.
Well, that's one of the issues that will be discussed this afternoon, the question of the rationing of scarce resources and the allocation of those resources based on some hierarchy of important issues. Now I don't have an answer to that question. I see it as something that's emerging. I'd simply point out that the Oregon action at this point has been declared discriminatory on the basis of the Americans with Disabilities Act adopted last year. So for that reason, at the moment at least, it's not a consideration.
I don't think that all forms of rationing are morally wrong. I think you have to distinguish several levels of decision making. A government can decide through whatever means that government uses, some sort of representative means in our circumstances, how it will spend its resources. And it can't spend all its resources on medical care. You need schools and roads and all sorts of things. So that at a kind of macro level, decisions have to be made about how much of our resources we will pump into medical care. It may be that they're just isn't enough to do everything that one would like to do. No one is treated unjustly under those circumstances. If, however, a political community has decided that it will provide a certain sort of care, as, for instance, in this country, we provide kidney dialysis now. We're in a lot of arguments about it now, whether we should have, but we do. Then if I'm your physician and I say, you know, I really think these resources could be used better for somebody else. I know he needs dialysis, but I never thought much of him anyway. At the micro level, in other words, at the micro level, the physician's responsibility is to use the resources available for the patients who can be helped by them. That doesn't mean, however, at the macro level, that a community has to cannot ration its resources in any way. Whether the Oregon way is the best to do or not, I mean, complicated questions. But I don't want to rule it out. I want to distinguish levels of decision making. The problem is that those two levels of decision making are often getting blurred and merged today.
Let me add one other point to that particular question, and that is, informally, it's being done all the time. So there's nothing new, really, about raising the question. The question is whether it should be done formally by state action or whether it is left to an individual set of circumstances to make that determination.
And I would like to express the Neanderthal view on the very basic issue to begin with, that I think we took a wrong turn somewhere when we turned more and more of this over to a huge bureaucratic entity that we call the federal government. I can think of at least a dozen agencies that I would prefer to have some responsibility for my health care than the direction that we are going, but I suppose it's irreversible. I don't know.
May also be terminal.
My question is basically for Mr. Lindsay or Dr. Lindsay. I'm Nancy Valcom. I'm with Missouri Nurses for Life. I'm a cancer nurse full-time, and I'm also very involved in disability rights. I have had a mother with Alzheimer's and cancer, a daughter with Down syndrome and heart problems, a husband disabled from mental illness, and a grandmother who is pleasantly senile in a nursing home. And we kind of run the gamut. That's just a few of them. But when we look at legislation, I know this year in Missouri, they brought up the idea of a health care consent law and implied surrogate law. When we talk about living wills, durable powers of attorney and all this, we talk about the incapacitated, of whom all of my relatives were conscious but would have been considered incapacitated under that definition. They brought up a law about basically getting rid of the pieces of paper, the living wills, the surrogate laws, things like that, and just having it to the guardian or next of kin to make whatever decision, so people wouldn't have to sign, and basically we would all be under our families or our guardians, or if we're elderly, some bureaucrat, to determine what kind of health care that we have. I'm very concerned about protecting the disabled. My relatives, I've had to fight for several of them to get proper treatment. I can help protect my relatives while I'm alive, and I'm very concerned about if any of them would outlive me. Some of them have not. If there would be protections in the law. My question to you is, has any state passed that type of law, whereas the next of kin would take over making any health care decisions without any formal declaration from the person, any indication of what the person would want? And secondly, what kinds of protections? When I read the bills this year, and they're certain to come up again next year, I saw an awful lot about immunity for health care providers, immunity for families, immunity for guardians, nothing about protecting the rights of the disabled. And I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, let me take the last question first, and that is specifically that has been a concern, that the emphasis has been on the health care provider, and that the purpose of some of the legislation in the states has been to indemnify the provider against lawsuits, and as you point out, without much concern for the individual. As to the first part of your question, what about surrogate activity protecting members of a family after you have passed on? I don't know of any state that has that kind of legislation. I think it is a concern, but it seems to me that that has to be worked out with some other people besides yourself.
Well, basically with this particular thing, if they go to the next of kin, there wouldn't have to be any formality of making it out, particularly the next person would take it over after that.
Well, I have a problem specifically in a generic sense with next of kin, because the next of kin may be the person who profits most from the estate, mm-hmm. and he may well be interested in having this person pass on. So I have looked at some of the statutes which require that the individual who engages in that activity as a surrogate should not be a beneficiary of the estate.
That's an interesting point. I noticed between the living will and our durable, the surrogate bill that we had, in one, the person who could witness it in the living will could not be someone who had an interest, but in the other one they could, which was real interesting. Thank you.
Fred Stenfeld, the moderator got in his word to be succinct before I got here, so I know I'm going to leave this microphone feeling guilty, but I'm sure forgiveness is there. I do have a question, but I went through an experience just last week to affirm something Dr. Millender said. We, Proposition 161, we're dealing with in California, and it's amazing. We hear nothing about it. I mean, no advertisements are being on it for or against, and it's fascinating, unless it somehow comes out towards the election. But we had our ethics committee meeting last week, and I presented Proposition 161. We have about 12 members on the ethics committee. Not one of them had read it yet. Until I distributed to them a week before. And we were discussing some of the aspects of it, the left-hand kingdom aspects of it might get out of hand, and doctors are healers and not killers, and things like that. And then it came my turn to reflect, and I brought up the concept of, in our religious tradition, you know, we believe in stewardship, God is creator, and stewardship. But then I spoke on an aspect that really touched all of them. I was amazed by it. I was stunned by it. The concept that, you know, we talk about autonomy, and we're stressing patient rights, and independence is not the goal of human life. Interdependence is. That we are interdependent upon one another, and that's so important to human life, and to become truly human, we need one another to be giving and receiving. And in sickness, we receive care of others, and we give the opportunity for others to become more human by giving that care. And I went on in that interdependence kind of concept. And when I stopped, there was absolute silence in that committee. That's unusual. And the person across the table said, I never heard that before. And the doctor next to me said, you know, he says, I just went through that. A relative had become sick, and he said, I never saw our family so united and working together, as in this. So it went into that kind of a discussion. And a moral aspect was able to be brought in there and a witness be given on the right-hand kingdom, which I think is an opportunity for us to bring in and to remember in this autonomous thing about our creation as social beings. But I do have a question, too. I guess the question, what is life? We talk about right to death, and I don't think this has been talked about. Do I have the right to allow God to call me home and not to have a machine stand in the way between me and the presence of God? That's putting it in a different way. We have, as I mentioned, yes, we have 160 patients that have nasal gastral tubes, and we are aware now in California that the NG tube is considered a treatment, not, you know, because normally when a patient comes in and they need nutrition, in goes the tube, but there's no way of taking it out once it's in. But now that it's considered a treatment, it can be withdrawn when it is decided that it is no longer of a benefit to help that patient in recovery. But I'm concerned with our attitude. Do we define life? Is, because life has honor, we say that. But is life that is sustained, is bodily function that is sustained by a machine considered life? Or is there any guilt in determining to turn off a machine? Or I have the right. This concept that we talk about, heaven is our home, and in our Christian perspective, can we say sometimes we're standing in the way of God?
Well, I think, of course, in an ultimate sense, the definition of life is knowing God and being in a relationship with Him, and that's a continuum that goes on through. Of course, you're talking about physical life, no doubt, and definition is much more difficult. You have the Harvard criteria, which seem to take a lot of precedence today, but there others would be much more qualified to speak on that than I am.
I didn't want to address that, but I have before me a list put out by an organization called No on 161, and there are 31 organizations in the state of California that oppose Proposition 161. So you certainly can find out about it, enlist their services, and participate in the effort.
I'm going to take a little while. But this is a complicated question that you're raising, on which opinions have shifted a great deal over the last 10 years or so. In 1984, I wrote an article on removing feeding tubes from permanently unconscious patients, arguing against what I took to be just a sort of growing trend in favor of it. And I've discovered since then that I could sort of spend my life being the token representative of that view on panels of one sort or another. That's how fast it shifted over 10 years. I think you need to keep in mind the two criteria that I articulated. The question is this either useless or is it burdensome? Right. Now, they're both tricky here in some ways, but uselessness especially needs thought. This person is probably living a life that none of us would choose, given alternatives. Doesn't mean, however, that he or she ceases to be a living human being. And to sustain the life of a living human being isn't useless. Okay? So that I don't think you should assume that the fact that the person is permanently unconscious even means that it's useless to sustain that life. Burdensomeness is also tricky in various ways. For the permanently unconscious patients, however, the ones that people most want to remove the feeding tubes from, it's hardest to prove that it's burdensome because there's no evidence that they're experiencing it as burden. There may be other cases. There are severely demented patients in nursing homes who are intubated and who regularly pull the tubes out and would finally have to be restrained, for instance. Now, that, I take that maybe as evidence that they're experiencing burden in some way, so that they're different kind of cases. But the ones that people most readily assume we should stop tube feeding, the permanently unconscious, are the ones that it's hardest to make the argument for. There's a lot more that could be said about it, but he's breathing down my neck here.
I'm Paul Winningham, a pastor from Uniontown, Missouri. And I don't have a question. I only have a plea that, Dr. Bergdorf, you would take that brief moment and make that excursus on the manic depressive and the right to die, if it pleased the crowd.
Minute and a half.
Please.
Yeah, Pastor Bergdorf said he could do it in a minute and a half.
Or so.
I mean, to find it, it'd take me a minute and a half. Wait a minute. Let's see here.
Another question you would collect your...
Oh, here it is. Okay. All right. I'm sure my experience in dealing with people who have the affliction of manic depression is not unique. I don't know the rate of suicide among people with manic depression. I'm sure it's very, very high. I know there are cases in which the victim refrains from suicide primarily because of a deeply held conviction that to do so is to violate a very important principle of Christianity. I'm also aware there are others with similarly deep convictions who do not end their lives in this manner. You probably know you can hold their hands, you can counsel without limit, medication can be prescribed, taken, changed, improved, and just when everyone is quite encouraged that the sufferer is feeling much better, he or she succeeds in terminating his or her life. And it just seems to me this is a very special kind of case. I believe that even though such a person seems far more rational than a schizophrenic or a person subject to any of a variety of dementia, there exists in the manic depressive an intermittent state or spate of irrationality that equals that of the most demented in our midst. And therefore, I do not believe that the suicide of a manic depressive is ordinarily an act of unbelief. And of course, it is unbelief which condemns.
Well, I'm not even going to try to spell out the view and son and defend it, but just lest we think that we can't have any differences of opinion here, I just want to go on record as saying that I don't think that even rational suicide necessarily condemns one. I'm not even going to try to give you the reasons. I'm going to talk to you later if you want to, but it's a complicated question, and I'm not willing to acquiesce in that judgment.
Raise a different question. The question of burden that you brought up, you know, it probably should be framed somewhat differently in terms of what constitutes an undue burden. Our courts do recognize that people live with burdens. The question is, when does that burden become an undue burden? The question arose originally and was defined in connection with cases involving interstate commerce. That was where the undue burden question was raised. Most recently, it's been raised by Sandra Day O'Connor in the Casey case that comes out of Pennsylvania. The abortion case there.
I count 2, 4, 6. Maybe there's one more left. We have approximately 10 minutes left in the session, so you can do your own division, and I would ask that we even extend the time by just a minute or two, but to allow the people that are presently in line to ask their question, please.
My question is mostly for Dr. Bergdorf, but for everyone on the panel. It comes in two parts. First of all, I'm kind of disappointed that you're discussing medical decision-making and one of us is not represented on your panel. My name is Nancy Lass. I'm a faculty member of SLU's Medical School. I'm also a pediatrician. For those of you that do not understand this definition, I'm just going to tell you quick. I'm what you call a neonatologist. I specialize in intensive care of very sick newborn infants. And I would like to pose two very quick scenarios, since I have to make these decisions every day of my life. And I've made some of these decisions. How you would reflect on those, Dr. Bergdorf, as a theologian, and then, gentlemen, if you have other views as well. The first is very simple. You have a baby who is about 25 weeks gestation. That's approximately halfway through. And for those of you from the Roe v. Wade era, that's right about at the definition of viability. The parents are young, say about 22, 23 years old. They've had trouble with infertility for some period of time. Mom has had about 5 miscarriages. She finally conceives. This child is born early. Obviously, this baby is very much wanted. They're Christian parents. The child weighs about 600 grams. For those of you that haven't seen these kids, they're about the size of my hand. The skin is not mature at all. If you even put tape on, when you remove it off, it'll peel the skin right off. This child has suffered every complication known to man. He has very bad lung disease from immaturity. He's had intracranial hemorrhages on both sides, and for the sake of making this easy, we've gone and checked his brainwave, and the scan is totally a flat line. The parents, because of the infertility issues, are very, very emotionally charged, and as we said yesterday, this changes your view sometimes on a decision. The parents want every possible thing done. I am trying to acquiesce that request. This child has had a cardiac arrest
3 times in the last 24 hours. I can no longer keep the blood pressure up with massive support. Again, the reason I mention the skin is because as the child really is in a state of dying, that will start to decompose right in front of you. The medical staff, the nursing staff is very distressed in dealing with this case. The parents are convinced the child will live and be healthy and be the next president. Is it unreasonable for us, A, to suggest that this ventilator be removed since this child is, in fact, by the criteria, let's say the Harvard criteria, as best we have in the newborn, brain dead? If the parents choose to say, we really do not wish to see this child suffer anymore, which it's quite obvious that's what's happening, is it inappropriate then for me to withdraw the ventilator support?
I have twice now been promoted to the status of doctor, which I am not. But I want to say, too, I'm disappointed that you're not on the panel also, because then you'd be answering the question instead of me.
I'd still be asking you.
But really, give your name to the planners, and there quite likely may be an opportunity to be on such a panel at a future time, because this, I think, will likely be repeated. But in a word, might it be proper to withdraw the ventilator in this emotionally charged situation? Of course, there's all kinds of ramifications, but in one word, I would say no, it would not necessarily be improper. Perhaps there's a conflicting opinion.
I think Kevin O'Rourke on your campus would support that.
He does.
I mean, you have a complicated problem of human relations, but you don't have a difficult problem about what your obligation to that baby really is. On your own description, the baby is probably already dead, actually a corpse, and you're under no obligation to ventilate a corpse. Or if not that, clearly irretrievably dying, and you're under no obligation to provide futile treatment. Now, you have a complicated human interaction problem, but I mean, I think you probably face actually a lot tougher issues in some other cases, just as far as the morality of what your obligation to the patient is.
Well, then part two, which is your ordinary means as opposed to extraordinary means, to coin an old phrase. If I then had an infant that was born, let us say this time the child is full term and has multiple congenital anomalies. Many of you know of Down syndrome, which is trisomy 21, that's 3 of the 21st chromosome. If the child had, say, 13 or 18, which is usually a lethal defect within the first, say, 2 weeks to month of life. That's under normal circumstances. The child comes out, we don't know there's a problem. The child initially gets placed on a ventilator. Within 3 days, I have a count from the geneticist so that I know that this is the defect. And I know that if I withdraw the ventilator support right now, the child will indeed survive for maybe the duration of the week. Then he'll have a respiratory arrest, and that would be the end. He cannot also feed on his own, so he would require a nasogastric tube. Is it then unreasonable for me to withdraw the support of the ventilator and suggest to the parents that they then have the opportunity, knowing the child will die without the ventilator, not necessarily within that day, but within a time frame, is it unreasonable to withdraw that ventilator support and suggest to the parents, as we often do, that they can take this baby home, get the chance to know this child in whatever natural, normal environment they can possibly provide, nurture that child in whatever best way they can, and then that child would then die a, quote, natural death at home? There are folks that oppose the taking away of the ventilator in that case. Your opinions, gentlemen?
That's the very best thing you could do. I mean, I'd approve of it. There are a lot of reasons to give, but it seems appropriate to me. They're not abandoning that infant.
I support what Gil says, but I'd also point out that the burden of decision doesn't necessarily rest on your shoulders alone, that there are others in the caring community that should be involved in counseling with the parents as well as dealing directly with the child.
We do our best to involve them.
Agreed.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Ma'am? Are you on? Pastor Hines from Iowa West. With regard to Dr. Melander, with regard to excessively burdensome, if treatment would be either useless or excessively burdensome, my question would be, where is the best emphasis placed? Excessively burdensome to whom? In other words, the patient or to the family? And then criteria, pain, threshold of pain, money, time, family relationships? Where would the best emphasis be placed, upon the patient or the family of the patient?
How can I come to this citadel of German Lutheranism and be called Melander?
Melander. My name is H-I-N-E-S. I'm a dumb
I'm a dumb blindy line, and I don't. I'm not German.
I don't hold it against you. It's burden to the patient. I perhaps didn't make that as clear as I ought to have, but what's at stake there in that criterion is burden to the patient, but not to others. That burden, however, may be of a variety of kinds. It wouldn't have to be solely sheer physical suffering. It could be even the way it... I could decide to decline treatment and not deplete the resources that I want to leave my family, and that's conceivable that that would be a permissible decision. But when we start to read it as burden to, you know, some larger group of caregivers or something like that, then I think what we're going to find, if we think it through clearly, is, again, as I put it, we're taking aim at the treatment, at the person, not at the treatment.
And then finally, to Reverend Bergdorf, or to whom it may concern, is there a new term out with regard to manic depressive called bidispolar syndrome? I think I've, is that correct?
Bipolar.
Bipolar disorder. Okay, thank you. Thank you much.
Reverend Bergdorf, David Minch from Utica, Nebraska. There's a basic question that I'm still trying to sort through, and I'll ask a series of questions to relate the controversy, and maybe you can relate to that. Is physical death contrary to God's will for humanity, his initial will? And if so, is physical death evil? Or at least from the kingdom of darkness? Does it grow out of the kingdom of darkness? And then can we say, is it initiated by God or Satan? I guess what I'm getting at is, do we need to be careful when we say God will call us to himself? Because do we give credence to this popular folk opinion that I think might be errant, I'm not sure, I'd like some help, that people say his number was up and there was nothing else that could be done and God was finished with him here on earth or whatever. How do we balance, if this is from the kingdom of darkness, how do we balance that with the statement that says God will determine the time of death? Now, is it possible and is it correct to say that God does not cause the death, but that he calls a Christian home when death is a reality? And how does that relate to the whole issue of encouraging or speeding up the time of death?
There are a lot of questions here, and I don't know that I can answer all of them, or I'll forget some of them. First of all, is physical death according to the will of God, or is it an evil thing in itself? All right, originally, of course, as you well know, it was not in God's plan. We talk about the antecedent and the consequent will of God. The antecedent being what he intended from the beginning, and death was never in that picture at all, and it was indeed an evil. The consequent will of God, however, is that because of the reality of man's rebellion, death did enter the picture, and rather than allow him to continue in the gross imperfection which characterizes this world, he sets a time in which he calls that person to himself. Now, we are not determinists in the sense that we don't jump out of the way of a moving truck because we believe it's our time, then God is going to call us in that fashion. We still get out of the way. And that is not to say that we cannot, by an act of our will, change what may be regarded as God's time for us to be called home. But nevertheless, it is still within God's province, ultimately, or his right, his due, for him to determine that rather than ourselves. Now, does that leave other questions hanging that I haven't addressed at all? I'm sure it does.
This probably isn't the place to pursue it further.
I'll be glad to talk with you individually.
Chuck Mansky, in addition to teaching ethics at Christ College and our Fort Wayne Seminary, I do produce the television program Christianity on Trial, which has been seen weekly for the last 6 years, over 300 television stations. And the reason I mention this is because I think some of us are looking for video material on exactly the subjects that have been given here. such as death and euthanasia on demand. And we have done about 12 of those programs on the series. And I think some of us are looking, as we're on local hospital medical ethics committees, for a video presentation of 27 minutes that kind of opens up a discussion. These programs are a Donahue type format, so we begin with professors of medicine from UCLA and professors from Loma Linda, which is a medical center run by the Seventh-day Adventists, by U.S. congressmen and others, so we get the diversity of opinion, but we always end up with a Lutheran perspective or a Lutheran conclusion. So we have programs like When Does Life Begin?, Death on Demand?, Should AIDS Be Reported?, Teenage Suicide?, Drugs, Abortion?, Who Controls Death?, in other words, some of the issues exactly we're talking about. And I would say if you're interested in ordering those, it's just Chuck Mansky, Christ College, Irvine, California, and I'll give you a listing of those tapes. Since we're running out of time, I'm going to forego my question. Thank you.
Barry Forrester, pastor in Arizona, backing away from specific issues, to ask the question, respecting the difference between the two kingdoms, when do issues turn from the religious or theological to the moral, and then to political? And then, having answered that question, perhaps all three of you addressing it, you know, where then does the church enter into discussion and apply its time and resources, and maybe when should it withdraw?
Well, the question that you raise is one, always a perplexing one. I suppose this conference is dedicated to the idea that the church has not been as active as it could be. I don't know how active it could be. Let me answer by quoting a famous theologian, Lutheran, who talked about some of these events and called them, at best, proximate solutions to insoluble problems. It's a mouthful, to be sure, but nonetheless, that's why we're talking about it here, and why we hope that there will be further discourse about these questions elsewhere, and that one should not look to St. Louis for answers, because we are all the church, wherever we are, and all have that responsibility.
Well, let me just add that I think that the church ought to be proactive and not only reactive as to when it should enter the discussion. Before the questions come up, the church itself ought to raise them, talk about them.
Don Schultz from Columbus, Georgia, also a lay person, recently attended a medical ethics symposium in the city of Columbus, Georgia, not Ohio, please, and had a privilege of listening to a Dr. Costner from Mount Sinai in New York, who is a medical ethicist and a very, very orthodox Jew. And he made several statements I'd like to repeat, and one of the statements I'd like to ask as a question to the panel. But several of the statements he made regarding withdrawal of feeding and hydrating tubes was the fact that this is equivalent to euthanasia. His feelings are that food and water are the same as giving loving care, talking, singing, holding hands with a patient, even if that patient is comatose. Remember, this is from an Orthodox Jew now. Another comment that I have heard mentioned one time so far in the meeting here in the symposium is futile. He talked about medical futility. This is not, and you cannot define medical futility. You have to draw a line of ranges where when does treatment become futile. The question I have regards to living wills, basically. And his statement was that if you are going to use a living will, his comment was that you should put into the living will the maximum treatment that you would accept rather than the minimums. I'd like the comments of the panel on that.
As to the question whether food and water are nutrition or treatment, that's precisely what is at issue, and that's what people have not been able to agree upon. I'd remind you of the statement of one of the Supreme Court justices years ago. It is on what is reasonable that reasonable people disagree.
I'm not a big fan of living wills, although I maybe don't oppose them as much as some who are here. But what I think ought to come to the fore in those discussions is something that was mentioned by somebody else, this gentleman here, I think. We need to talk about in terms of interdependence, and living wills are attempts to assert one's autonomy over one's life. That's why I much prefer durable power of attorney for medical care, which recognizes interdependence. I wrote a piece a while back titled, I Want to Burden My Loved Ones. It was set all downhill after the title, but still, it captures that issue, and I think the durable power of attorney is more a recognition of human interdependence than the living will is.
Thank you very much. I think the high level of interest is a testimony both to our audience and especially to our panelists, and we dismiss with thanks both to you and especially to our three guests that have made these excellent